The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
It's time for the Culture Club, and I'm delighted to be joined by one of Ireland's most innovative and finest of creative writers. Indeed, he teaches creative writing at the University of Limerick. He also writes a weekly books column for the Irish Times, lives much of his year in Berlin, but he's just published, following his first novel, Here Are the Young Men, which was then followed by This Is the Ritual. He's published Threshold, which, Rob Doyle, is it a novel or is it a, what is it?
Well, this is the question. I feel a kind of sense of glee and victory that I've written a book of which many of the reviews have gone out. A lot of them spend about a quarter or half of the review asking exactly that question, what kind of book it is. But I'm calling it a novel. To be honest with you, Matt, I don't really mind what people call it. All I was trying to do was to write a read, you know, a good read, something that people could really get into and be immersive. But it would be dishonest to call it a memoir because it has fictional elements. And
aren't all memoirs, though, comprised of fictional elements that people tend to dress up their own life story to create an impression for others, which may not necessarily be the reality of what happened?
This is true. I've just taken that and made it a bit more explicit. So there's lots of straightforward autobiography in there, or as straightforward as, you know, there's lots of stuff in there that
straightforward
really
lies.
There's straightforward fabricate. Yeah, hence my use of the phrase fiction or calling it a novel. But I suppose my definition of a novel, as I say in the book, it's anything I tell it to be. You know, novel, the word novel connotes novelty, newness, freshness. And so I feel if you're writing a novel, it doesn't have to have the same structure and obey the same conventions and rules as, you know, lots of other novels do. So this one, it kind of blends, travel, humor, narrative, confession, fiction, all of these things, criticism, you know, philosophical ideas into one big kind of...
That's a big canvas.
It's a big canvas. It is, yeah. I mean, 3-4 years working on this book, really. So I really put everything I kind of know and love and care about.
But with the end objective of what? I mean, it strikes me it's actually very entertaining. Yeah. And is that important to you as well as a writer, that ultimately, as well as engaging maybe the senses and the intellect of the reader, that you also entertain them?
Yes. I have a terrible fear of being a bore, even for one sentence. I can't let that happen. So, I think the best art for me manages to be entertaining and more than entertaining at the same time. In other words, it can engage the emotions and the intellect, as you say, and it can really get into some fairly deep territory of life, of selfhood, of what it is to be a human being, the human condition. But at the same time, it can, you know, be very entertaining and funny. And so I like to think I've written not just this book, but all my books would try to be a mixture of those two.
Well, before we get to the music and the movies and television, all those things, what are the books that you love? And if you were been forced, as we've asked you to do, to pick out favourite authors and favourite books, what would you go for?
Well, I mean, there are so many, you know, of course. Reading is my kind of lifeblood in terms of my own creative imagination to keep it fed. But so one that came to mind would be the Chilean novelist, Roberto Bolaño. He's a huge inspiration to me, a great wild storyteller, the weirdo's weirdo, as I've come to think of him. He's a complete maniac who somehow could channel that mania into writing dazzling stories and novels. He would be one. Borges, the Argentinian, would be another. Recently, Svetlana Alexievich, I think she's a Belarusian woman who won the Nobel Prize for such books as The Unwomanly Face of War. Again, people contest what kind of genre she's writing in. Is it nonfiction? Should she have won the Nobel Prize because is it just journalism? People don't know what to make of her, but her books are very affecting, and that's all that matters at the end of the day to me, really.
We have an extract from the audiobook, The Unwomanly Face of War, so let's just hear it.
And I would discover that in war, there is, apart from death, a multitude of other things. There is everything that is in our ordinary life, War is also life. I would run into countless human truths, mysteries. I would ponder questions the existence of which I had never suspected. For instance, why is it that we are not surprised at evil? Why this absence in us of surprise in the face of evil? A road and many roads. Dozens of trips all over the country. Hundreds of recorded cassettes. Thousands of yards of tape. 500 meetings, after which I stopped counting. Faces left my memory. Only voices remained. A chorus resounds in my memory. An enormous chorus. Sometimes the words almost cannot be heard. Only the weeping. I confess, I did not always believe that I was strong enough for this path, that I could make it, could reach the end. There were moments of doubt and fear when I wanted to stop or step aside, but I no longer could. I fell captive to evil. I looked into the abyss in order to understand something.
Tell me a little bit more about that, Rob Doyle, that book. What's the unwomanly face of war? What's the background to it?
So this is an author. She's an elderly lady now, but she's a woman who, as a journalist in Soviet Russia in, I think, the late 70s, she was looking around and she was reading all these great war books. And she basically realized that war was always, even in the literature she loved and admired, was always recounted from a male perspective. And it had never been really told, particularly the Second World War, from a woman's perspective. And so she made it her mission, an obsession it became for her, to kind of travel the length and breadth of Russia and speak to the women who had lived through the war, whether they were soldiers, and a lot of them were, snipers, medics, whether they were just civilians, all of these different people. And essentially from these amassed voices, I think she did hundreds, if not thousands, of interviews. And from these amassed voices, she kind of put them all together into this epic chorus of voices, of narratives, of stories. But the fascinating thing, and what makes it so different from all the other war books I've ever read, is that in telling their stories, these women, they're not really talking about the names of the generals and the battalions that moved here and there. They're just talking about the human truth.
The consequences.
Consequences, the horror, the full severity of the horror of, you know, families being torn apart, of people being tortured. And I mean, the war, as we all know, the Second World War in Russia was brutal beyond anything we can almost imagine. But also, you know, the tenderness, the frailty, the compassion. I would kind of defy anybody to read that book and not be shaken, really moved by it. It has that kind of Russian grandeur of spirit to it.
But just as somebody who writes with real beauty and flair, just going through Threshold, your new book, how much do you trust translations of books from other languages? Everyone that you've mentioned there writes in a different language and is translated into English. So, I mean, if your work has been translated into their languages, how well do you think would it actually translate? The substance of the story might be there, or the expression, but do you actually get the real use of the language?
Well, this is a good question, and it is one I've thought about, because as you point out, I definitely do a hell of a lot of reading in translation. And I used to, probably when I was younger, I would just read work in translation without really questioning it too much. I would just take it at face value. But now I've read, for example, an author like Borges, the great Argentinian genius. I've read various translations of the same short stories, and they can be very different. And so you realize that translation is an art, so much so that with my favorite authors in translation, I've started to know who my favorite translators are and so on. So I think the best translators tend to be writers in their own right. They tend to be poets or novelists or something, who, so that you know that they're sympathetic to the needs of not just narrative and storytelling, but language itself.
Okay, Rob Doyle is with us for the Culture Club. I'm going to move off books and I'm going to move to television. We asked you to nominate a television show that you loved as a child, as a teenager, because that can often inform what you go on to enjoy as an adult. you've picked The X-Files. Why so?
Oh, because I was, I suppose I was a kid and a teenager in the 90s. And when The X-Files came out, it completely blew me away. You know, who knows? You probably have listeners of a whole big age range, but some of them won't even remember this show. And some will, and some will have the same nostalgic fondness for it as I did. There was nothing like it at the time. It seemed so very dark and so paranoid and edgy and just fascinating that it had a whole kind of mythos and a whole aesthetic that went with it. And
well, let's hear a scene from The X-Files featuring David Duchovny as Mulder, Gillian Anderson as Scully.
Hello?
Hey, Mulder, it's me. What are you doing?
I'm working at the computer. What are you doing?
I'm packing. Just, you know, getting ready for our trip back to D.C. tomorrow.
You know, Scully, I was just thinking about Lazarus, Ed Wood, and those tofurkey-eating zombies. How come when people come back from the dead, they always want to hurt the living?
Well, that's because people can't really come back from the dead, Mulder. I mean, ghosts and zombies are just projections of our own repressed, cannibalistic, and sexual fears and desires. They are who we fear that we are at heart, just mindless automatons who can only kill and eat.
Party pooper. Well, I got a new theory. I say that when zombies try to eat people, that's just the first stage. You see, they've just come back from being dead, so they're going to do all the things they missed from when they were alive. So first they're going to eat. Then they're going to drink, then they're going to dance and make love.
Oh, I see. So it's just that we never get to stay with them long enough to see the gentler side of the undead.
Exactly.
Great. Taking me right back.
What was so great about it? It was sort of quite nonsensical in some respects. I mean, well, was there not a lot of bull in relation to what they were talking about?
Well, you see, I was kind of an age young enough. When I was a kid, I was very into the paranormal. And I was the kind of nerdy kid who would like look at the sky for UFOs and kind of keep notes of what I was seeing and stuff. And then you had this show, which seemed incredibly adult and grown up and sophisticated at the time, much like the clip we've just heard. And it kind of fed into that part of my imagination. But also, I think it was just that wonderful dynamic of those two main actors, you know, David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. And everyone, all the boys had a crush on Gillian Anderson, and all the girls, no doubt, had a crush on Fox Mulder. And it was just the chemistry between them and that kind of interplay of his paranoid conspiratorial mind and her rational skepticism. It really worked well over several seasons.
Now, you've made some current day choices as well, which I actually love as well. I'm going to start with The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Here's a scene featuring Edgar Ramirez as Gianni Versace and Penelope Cruz as his sister Donatella.
Which of these are yours?
Mine.
These are not your sketches.
No, my idea is there. A dress as a weapon.
What are you? Are you a designer? No, what are you? What are you? Are you a collector of other people's ideas?
Call me what you want.
No. Tell me, how do you call yourself?
I assist you the best that I can.
You have the opportunity to be great, and you choose to assist.
No, none of us chose this situation, Gianni.
Gianni, maybe you should rest.
I won't talk to you when you are like this.
No, this is how I talk. And if you don't like it, good. We never talk again.
Gianni, I know what you are angry, and I'm angry too, but it's not my fault.
I'm sick. We have to face it. Because I cannot hide it.
What do you want from me?
I want everything.
You have it all. I give you all.
Then it's not enough.
What did you enjoy, Rob Doyle, from The Assassination of Gianni Versace so much?
This show, and it's only 10 episodes, but this series left me utterly emotionally devastated. I went to watch it not really having heard much about it. I vaguely remembered the story. I didn't pay much attention to the story when I was a teenager, when Gianni Versace was assassinated by a serial killer in Miami in, I suppose, the late 90s. So I didn't really know much about the story, and I watched the first two or three episodes, and it was so intensely gruesome and disturbing that I was wondering, was this just a shock factor kind of show? But then somehow the narrative got its hooks into me, and I realized as the story unfolded, it was something far more profound and emotionally intense. And it was definitely a binge watch. I think I stayed up till about 5 or 6 the second night of watching it to get right to the end. I couldn't look away, but when I finished it, I was just flattened. I felt completely hollowed out by the story. It went into very dark places,
and very sad for some of the victims of the serial killer. You really felt for them and how they had been caught up in something completely not of their own making. And the humanity involved in it as well. It was an incredible series.
It was a masterclass in humanity as in narrative and empathy and narrative sophistication too. The way they started out with this guy committing an act of absolute evil and then gradually made you, he never redeemed himself. He was a complete and utter evil monster. But even by the end of it, even him, you kind of saw what had turned him into this monster. And so it just was great fiction for me.
It is. It's on Netflix. I'd recommend it to anyone who actually hasn't seen it. I'm not going to play a clip of your other choice because I've been playing so much of it recently. I think people are going to believe it. I'm forcing it on all our guests because I'm so much in love with Succession, but you've also picked it.
Oh, yeah. So, I think I'm one of the crowd in this one. I was aware of that when I chose it, that everybody seems to have been taken by it. And usually I'm one of those contrarian people who, if everybody is cheering something on, I'll kind of go the other way. But with this one, I have to say, it just completely, I just thought it was a masterclass in great writing. The characterization, the dialogue, I mean, the pungency, the vulgarity, the intelligence and the humor. I mean, I was did a lot of laughing out loud watching it, which is always a big plus for me. If something can make me laugh, I'm in.
We're going to move now to music for your selections. And I'm going to start with the best gig you're at, because from reading the threshold, it's quite clear you're all into very sensual stuff. And Leonard Cohen at the Royal Hospital Kilmainham in June 2008 is something you've picked out as the best gig you were at, presumably for the sort of almost sensual experience of it.
For everything, for the sheer perfection of the night. I remember being at that gig. I think he played 3 nights there. And yeah, like you say, it was just over a decade ago. And I remember it was this sunny day and it was this outdoor gig. The sound was perfect. And then this elegant, elderly, great, beloved genius came on and gave these extraordinary renditions of all of his marvelous songs. And I remember turning to the friend I was with and kind of we were thinking to ourselves, is it just us or is this the greatest gig ever? And then what I noticed afterward, in the wake of those gigs, everybody else seemed to be saying the same thing. And we were like, oh no, it wasn't just us. These gigs were extraordinary. He just had such charm, such magnetism, such, again, humanity. I mean, I've been a lifelong lover of his art and his music and his struggle, really. I think that's why people found him until, his death a year or so ago so compelling, is that his art, his music is the document of his own intense struggles as a human being. And, that struggle is really just being alive, isn't it? And so that's why the songs are so relatable. So that was unforgettable.
We actually have part of him at the Royal Hospital Kilmainham in that month in 2008. And this is where he sung Hallelujah.
I did my best, it wasn't much. I couldn't feel, so I learned to touch. I've told the truth, I didn't come all this way just to fool you. And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand right here before the Lord of Song with nothing. Hallelujah, hallelujah.
Rob Doyle, it strikes me listening to that as well that he wasn't a man, even that at an advanced stage of his career, somebody who many people felt was doing it because he wanted to make back money that he lost. He wasn't going through the motions. He was actually really putting everything into that.
Yeah, you see, I ended up reading a biography or two in the years subsequent to those gigs, and I think there was that element that he had been ripped off, I suppose, while he was away in the monastery as a Buddhist monk, and he came down and all his money was gone. I can't remember the details of it, but so there was that element that he needed to kind of go back to recoup some of his income. At the same time, by all accounts, he decided, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to give people
do it properly. Okay, we also asked you to pick out the first single you can remember buying. You went for a cassette single.
Yeah.
From the Presidents of the USA and the song Peaches. Why?
Yeah, I wonder, do many people remember that song? But I don't know. I can't remember why. Just that I must have heard it on MTV. I think I came to music a bit late in that it was only in my early teens that I really started. You know, some people, maybe that's the age people get into music, but that was when I really started to get into music. And, you know, I was watching MTV and just trying to find out what I liked, and I heard that song Peaches, and it was great. It was a mixture of melody and punk and energy, and so I ended up really liking that band.
Let's hear it.
Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Peaches come from a can.
Good bit older than you, Rob, but I actually haven't heard that song in years, but I used to love it at the time. Yeah, from the grunge of the 90s.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah.
Stuff.
And it had a melody. It had a pop edge to it too, you know.
We asked you for favourite act or favourite band. You've gone for Bright Eyes.
Yeah, well, that would be the songwriter Conor Oberst and his band, which they're kind of, I think they've just reformed, but they haven't really played for the best part of a decade. He's had his solo career, equally compelling, but he's, I guess the really lazy and quick way to say it is, I feel like he's almost doing what Bob Dylan did for the 60s generation for, you know, the 21st century, in just that he's just a songwriter of great genius and flair and lyricism. Very prodigious. You know, he seems to have an album every year or two, and the standard tends not to dip.
Let's hear First Day of My Life.
First day of my life, swear I was born right in the doorway. I went out in the rain, suddenly everything changed. They're spreading blankets on the beach. Yours is the first face that I saw. I think I was blind before I met you. I don't know where I am, I don't know where I've been, but I know where I want to go. And so I thought I'd let you know. Yeah, these things take forever, I especially am slow. But I realized that I need you, and I wondered if I
could. Conor Oberst and Bright Eyes there. And we asked you as well to get a recent album for us, and you've picked Daytona by Pusha T.
Yeah, these days I listen to a fair amount of rap I suppose I always have done, but for about 10 years there, most of it just seemed so awful to me. I think rap was going through its kind of dark ages, maybe the way rock was for a period.
You mean violent, misogynistic in many of its lyrics?
Yeah, well, it was just this kind of gangster. I mean, he's kind of a bit of a gangster himself, but it was this kind of macho gangster stuff. And I think rap has almost had its kind of punk and its prog moments all at the same time in the last 10 years. And now it's become the most kind of vital and fascinating musical form of our times again. And Pusha T is, I guess he's in his early 40s now, and he's been in the game for quite a while. But just last year, he put out this very short album. I think it's only 23 minutes.
Let's hear If You Know, You Know.
If you know, you know. If you know, you know. If you know, you know. This thing of ours, oh, this thing of ours. A fraternity of drug dealers ringing off. I just happen to be alumni. Too legit, they still looking at me with one eye. The company I keep is not corporate enough. Child rebel soldier, you ain't orphan enough. A rapper turned trapper can't morph into us, but a trapper turned rapper can morph into Puff. Dance contest for the smokers. I predict snow, Al Roker. If you know, you know. I only ever looked up to Sosa. You all get a bird, this nigga Oprah. Brick layers and ball shorts. Coaching from the side of the ball court. If you know, you know.
We should see there. We're nearly out of time, Rob Doyle, so I need to move quickly to movies. If you're big into television, you read a lot. Do you watch a lot of movies?
I watch constant movies. Movies is probably the art form that I have the most uncomplicatedly happy relationship with. Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that like a lot of novels would just not be my thing. You know, I struggle with a lot of novels, even though I write books myself, which is probably why mine come out so kind of odd and
do you different. Cast novels aside and not finish them?
I would do that a fair bit. Yeah, I would do that a fair bit. I would read a lot more nonfiction, frankly, than fiction, you know, and a lot more kind of autobiography and stuff that's in the kind of liminal space between genres, like maybe the stuff I write to an extent.
So whereas tell me movies. What do you like in movies?
Yeah, films, anything. Give me a good story, I'm in. You know, it can be any genre, sci-fi, whatever, thriller. I would go to the cinema frequently, and I would watch probably 3-4 films a week. But the favorite film I chose was Enter the Void, a film directed by Gaspar Noé about a decade ago. I saw the premiere of this film in the Rio Cinema in London, in Dalston. The director attended it. I've actually written this as a kind of semi-fictional scene in Threshold. This film, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's about a guy. Young guy, he's an American, bit of a slacker in Tokyo, and he gets involved in some shady drug deals. He's reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and then the cops come, blow him away, and the rest of the film follows his disembodied spirit as it floats above the streets of Tokyo, trying to kind of make things right with his broken relationship with his sister and so on. It's for those who haven't seen it, that sounds unwatchably experimental, but it's not. It's completely grippy.
Let's hear a little extract from it.
Do you think Bruno has anything stronger than DMT?
Come on, you gotta fry your brain, man. You should finish the Book of the Dead. That'd be a lot better. You can wait until you die, then you get your big trip.
That book is still confusing to me. How would you explain it?
It's a little bit hard to explain. So basically, when you die, your spirit leaves your body. Actually, at first you can see all your life like reflected in a magic mirror. And then you start floating like a ghost. And you can see anything that's happening around you. You can hear everything, but you can't communicate with the world of the living. And then you see these lights, all these different lights of all different colors. These lights are the doors that pull you into higher planes of existence. But most people, they actually like this world so much that they don't want to be taken away. So that's when the whole thing turns into a bad trip. The only way out is to get reincarnated. Does it make any sense?
Yeah, I guess so.
Enter the Void is the movie nominated by Rob Doyle. Rob, author of Threshold, Thank you very much for being with us here on the Culture Club on Today FM today.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.